You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 23rd of September 2022 on Monocle 24. The UK's new Chancellor sets out his stall. Markets appear unconvinced. Italy contemplates electing a far-right populist while Brazil considers unelecting one. And what is being worn in Milan this Fashion Week? I'm Andrew Miller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. It's Friday, so it's our weekly in-house daily, and among the Monocle staff not able to evade participation, even despite fleeing as far as Milan and Sao Paulo, are Chiara Ramella, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Natalie Theodosi. They'll look at the day's big stories, and we'll hear from Phil Grabsky about his latest film chronicling the wretched recent history of Afghanistan. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. The early reviews are discouraging. Following today's unveiling of a sort of mini-budget by the UK's recently installed Chancellor of the Exchequer, Kwasi Kwarteng, sterling plunged to a 37-year low against the US dollar, and the thick end of 2% came off UK share indexes. The headline measure of Kwarteng's announcement was 45 billion quid in tax cuts, including a cut in the basic rate paid by most wage earners, but also very much including the abolition of the top rate of income tax levied against those already clearing £150,000 a year, i.e. those who were probably struggling along all right. I'm joined with more on this by the business journalist Tadhg Enright. Tadhg, first of all, the reactions of the markets, are they actually as damning as they look?
Hi, Andrew. It's hard to escape that conclusion. Investors vote with their pounds, euros and dollars, and they've been taking them off the table today. And let's not forget, these are people for whom other people's money is actually their job to manage, their responsibility. Investors like predictability and orthodoxy. Now, some elements of today's package, like the national insurance reduction, had been expected, but others came out of the blue, such as eliminating the top rate of tax for top earners. And while cutting taxes is conservative fiscal orthodoxy, and generally investors like it, fiscal conservatives like it, so too, though, is fiscal responsibility. There's a mantra that you don't borrow money to cut taxes, and that is what is going to happen here. And there are critics even within, of course, the Conservative Party, Liz Truss's party, including her former contender for the leadership, the former Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, who just a month or so ago was saying that cutting taxes would be fueling inflation at a time when the objective is to rein it in. And he has not been saying much today.
Well, let's try at least to consider this from the government's point of view. From the perspective of Kwasi Kwarteng and, of course, Liz Truss, what is the big idea here? What are they trying to accomplish?
Well, they come from a school that believes that taxes and regulation are the main things that are holding the UK economy back. And many people would agree that taxes and regulation do restrain growth. But you should only consider cutting them, of course, if you have a sensible alternative, another way to balance the books, or perhaps more sensible regulations. Truss and Kwarteng are working on the premise that growth can compensate for all the other problems, the rising tides that lifts all boats, making people richer, rich people richer, will make everyone richer. They call it, as we know, trickle-down economics. It was 1980s Reaganite and Thatcherite thinking that has long since gone out of fashion. Now, Truss said in recent days that she was willing to make unpopular decisions to bring about growth. And these decisions will be, I think, very unpopular with the majority here, particularly those who won't benefit as much as the ultra rich.
Well, is it a purely rigidly, as they would see it, pragmatic economic idea, this one especially of cutting or abolishing that top tax rate? Or is there an ideological underpinning to it, that they're dogmatically committed to this because they think think that rich people should just have more of their money, because as you correctly point out, while it will obviously be popular with people who do make more than 150 grand a year, there's only about 600,000 of them.
Yeah, it is undoubtedly old-fashioned conservative. Make the rich richer, give the wealth creators the space in which to create more wealth, and that will benefit everyone. That's the school of thought. But of course, conservatism, or the UK Conservative Party, and indeed the American Republican Party, has in some degree shifted in recent years, where there is more of a focus on lower earners and giving them a break and giving them a fair slice of the pie, even if it does cut economic growth overall. But yes, this is going back to very, very basic conservative, as you put it, ideologically driven economic thinking, which is that growth must trump absolutely everything, even if, of course, as we all know, many of the levers which can bring about growth are unpopular with conservative voters. And here in the UK specifically, immigration and building houses in green fields.
So is there then even any self-interested political logic to this from Truss and Kwarteng's point of view? Because part of the mandate they have to govern, of course, was won by Boris Johnson in 2019, winning over largely working class Labour seats in the north of England, which had never even thought about voting Tory in their lives. And yet the attack lines for Labour here write themselves, don't they? People clearing £1 million a year have just been given a £50,000 a year pay rise, basically. And that is considerably more than most people who vote in this country even make.
That is certainly the case. Evidently, there's some people in control in Downing Street right now who think that it does make political and economic logic, although there are many murmurs within the party who believe it's electoral suicide. They're giving up those working class votes that the Conservatives fought so hard to steal away from Labour at the last election. And of course, if the markets are any barometer of investor opinion, clearly they don't see the logic to it as well. There are many who think that they are handing Labour the next election on a plate. That said, there are some even within the Conservative Party who think that just given the overall political cycle, that after 12 years in power and after pursuing many policies which seem to be, they would think great in the minds of their voters, but like difficult to implement in practice, that there is coming a natural end to this era of conservative leadership in this country. And perhaps Liz Truss and the people she surrounded herself with, and indeed the far-right think tanks who seem to be influencing so much of this government's policy, see a window of opportunity over the next two or so years between now and the next election to get some of their ideas over the line.
I mean, she can, in theory, as long as she can remain Prime Minister, the Conservative Party is entitled to hold power until January 2025. The most straightforward way to look at this, then, just to perceive Truss and Kwarteng stacking all their chips on red, giving the wheel a spin and hoping they get lucky?
I think that is a fair assessment, a fair analysis. But keep in mind that Liz Truss, upon becoming leader of the Conservative Party and therefore Prime Minister of the UK, was one of the most unpopular candidates to have managed to wiggle her way into that role. She commanded less than half the support of the parliamentary party and managed to get into office by simply winning over the majority support from that small fraction of the electorate overall, who happened to be paid up members of the Conservative Party.
Tighe Enright, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. You are listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. The next week and a half will see strangely complementary elections in two very different countries. On October 2nd, Brazil will decide whether it wishes to continue being governed by far-right populist blowhards. On September 25th, Italy will decide whether it actually quite fancies a go of such an arrangement. Possibly tellingly, polls suggest that the country which is currently run by bellicose hyper-conservatives is rather wearying of it, while the country that isn't seems determined to learn the hard way. Well, I'm joined by one Monocle staffer from each of those countries in question, in the studio by Monocle magazine's culture editor Chiara Ramella, and on the line from Sao Paulo by Monocle 24's producer and senior correspondent Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Chiara, first of all, let's look at Italy and let's look what the polls are saying. Now, despite the fact that Italian politics is Italian politics, Italian polls actually have a fairly solid record of calling it more or less right. So is there actually any way at all that Giorgia Meloni of the Brothers of Italy is not Italy's next prime minister?
It's very unlikely she won't be, is my double negative way to go around this issue. As you say, polls are considered to be quite reliable. We have to say, though, that because of the way that the campaigns are run, and there's always a bit of a break between the moments when the candidates are allowed to campaign, but also a break between the last official poll and then the subsequent polls are only released internally with the parties themselves. So the last official polls we have date back to about 13 September. Mm-hmm. And they say that Fratelli d'Italia is looking at getting around 27, maybe a bit less percent of the vote, and that generally speaking, the centre-right coalition is probably going to be riding around 45 to 50%. So it's very likely they will win. The only thing that could change, I guess, is seeing how well the Movement 5 Stars, the populist kind of non-ideological movement, is going to do in the south of the country. It's an area that's traditionally been less easy to break into for the League, the La Lega, which used to be much more focused on the northern side of the country. And also, Brothers of Italy is a fascist, neo-fascist, I should say, party, or at least a very far-right party that's very entrenched in its kind of Romanness in certain respects. It doesn't necessarily speak quite as well to the south of the country. Whilst a politician like Giuseppe Conte, our former prime minister, actually does have quite a lot of appeal in the south of the country. He's been doing lots of campaigning down there. It's very possible the Movement 5 Stars will make gains there. Mm. Also thanks to a policy that they claim as their own, which was the giving of benefits or like employment benefits more largely around the country. They claim it as a policy that they passed during their government. It's something that's very well loved in the south because that's where unemployment levels are higher compared to the north. So we can expect they can make gains there. And because of the way that the electoral seats are decided because of the electoral law, that could cause a bit of a stalemate in the Senate. But that's, I think, at this point, about it.
So, I mean, as you've delineated, the Brothers of Italy are usually pitched as far right. They do have their roots in extremely unsavoury, hardcore ultra-right circles, but what can we anticipate about how they might actually govern? Like, what would they actually do that is different to what is being done now?
Well, they have had to calm down a lot, or at least Giorgia Meloni has had to reframe her public persona quite a lot.
Is this like a Le Pen-style mainstreaming?
But to give you an idea of the level of the change that has happened, 3 years ago, Brothers of Italy, Fratelli d'Italia, was polling at about 4 to 5%, then out polling at 27%. So imagine also the extremism of what a party that's polling about 4 to 5% can say and do and represent in a country. And now that fringe is polling at 27%. It's astonishing. It really has changed completely the discourse in the country. And what can we expect? We can expect another crackdown on immigration, probably at least a disregard for LGBTQ plus rights, and a kind of, I guess, traditionalization of the discourse around family. We can expect a crackdown on that kind of welfare system of benefits for unemployment, which is considered by Giorgia Meloni to be I guess, encouragement of further unemployment in those who are too lazy to work. So I think just a radicalization of those policies all round.
Fernando, I will bring you in at this point, and there is another seamless link between Brazil's and Italy's elections, and I'll ask you to elaborate on that by explaining how and why a former Brazilian Formula One world champion is somehow running for office in Italy.
Well, he is indeed, and I have to say, he's going for the far-right party, which is, you know, a bit of a shame. So, as Chiara would know as well, so I think Italy is one of the few countries in the world where the Italian community, you know, they can actually vote and they have positions at the Senate and at Congress. So for Latin America, there used to be more, actually, but I believe for this election, there will be one position for the Senate and two for the Congress. We have a current senator in Italy, it's Fabio Porta from the center left. But the interesting thing here is, right, it always happened. But we have high profile candidates. Emerson Fittipaldi, I mean, all Brazilians know him, he's a former Formula One champion. But we also have on the other side, Andrea Matarazzo. He is a former ambassador. He's been a minister in governments here in Brazil, a very respected figure from the center left as well. So there's actually a lot of talk about the Italian elections in Brazil, not only because of that Brazilian component, but also because of the far right element, because we do have a president that can be said that he's far right, even though they're different countries, different political systems, there are differences indeed. But yeah, it's an election that Brazil is definitely keeping an eye on.
Fernando, we started out this segment talking to Chiara about the polling for Italy's election. So let's talk about the polling for Brazil's election as well. As we have discussed before during this campaign, it doesn't look too good for Jair Bolsonaro. Is that changing at all? Is he gaining any of that ground back?
He's not gaining any ground, but he's not losing votes as well. Lula, in the latest poll, he has a 47% of the vote. So there is a chance that he could win in the first round. It's too close to call at the moment, but I think that's what his campaign is doing, because there is the fear also in Brazil that if it goes to the second round, the election will become, there'll be dirty tricks, you know, there'll be more problematic, because as you know, Bolsonaro and democracy, sometimes they're two very different words. And I think if Lula wins in the first round, it'd be very hard for Bolsonaro to say that the election was a fraud, because then he'll be saying that the election of 27 governors, more than 500 MPs, senators as well, it's a lie. It's going to be very hard for him. I mean, he does have a large party in Congress, but I mean, it is very small. It's about 10% or so of the Congress.
Chiara, one of the reasons that Italy's election is being regarded with some concern around Europe is what it might mean for Europe's so far reasonably unified response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Now, the Italian right wing and the Italian far right certainly has an inglorious history of Putin worship, which has flared up again this week when former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, happy as always to help, has bought somewhat into the narrative that Russia was somehow elbowed or nudged or tricked into staging this confrontation by NATO's malfeasances. We were talking earlier about how Giorgia Meloni has tried to polish up the image of the Italian far right a bit. How are they going to style out the Putin worshipping problem? And are they actually going to be much help in the current conflict?
So this is one of the points on which the centre-right coalition is actually divided. Because Giorgia Meloni has been fairly straightforwardly pro-Ukraine and pro-alignment with the rest of the West. The problem is with Salvini and with Berlusconi, as you say. Berlusconi earlier this week made these really, really unfortunate and quite shameful comments where he basically bought into Putin's propaganda. And he's been accused across the spectrum, and he's been asked to apologize. And he said that it wasn't actually his opinions; he was repeating other people's opinions, which also doesn't help, I don't think. But bless him. I shouldn't really say that. But when you watch that video,
you said that in a sufficiently patronizing tone.
And when you watch that video, though, you can tell how much he's aged, really. I mean, we just must
most of him.
We must not forget that he really is a bit of a relic of his former self, and his party is polling much, much lower than it ever really did at his height. So, I don't think that Berlusconi will be really shaping the future of this coalition. In this poll, it's looking like 6.7%. Salvini is more problematic because he's more boisterous, and he hasn't gone as far as kind of supporting Putin's propaganda, but he has recently advocated for dropping sanctions against Russia, saying that he would say that not because he supports the invasion, but because he thinks that the sanctions don't work and they actually, you know, harm Italy more than they do Russia, which you could argue is yet another bit of kind of Putin-esque propaganda. So it's going to be difficult. And I think that Salvini was very, very upset by Ursula von der Leyen's comments about her concerns for the election in Italy. She was asked what she thought, and she said, you know, that whilst Europe would obviously work with any democratically elected government, they had tools to do something if things got difficult, which is sufficiently vague. But the Lega took great offense at this, saying that they were scaremongering, they were, you know, impeding people from voting with their hearts. And so they went and did a sit-in in front of the European institutions in Italy, asking for her apologies about this. So I think that he's going to still be a very troublemaking part of this coalition moving forward.
Fernando, just to bring you in finally, if those polls that you were discussing hold up, and if Lula does knock Bolsonaro over, especially if he does so in the first round, can we say there's anything there that other centre-left social democrats around the world who are up against far-right populists can learn from it? Or is it just a question of, unfortunately, allowing the far-right populists to govern for a bit and make it abundantly clear to everybody that they're really not terrifically good at it?
Unfortunately, Andrew, I have to say it's the latter, because 2018 was so hard. I mean, the Workers' Party, all the centrist parties, they did not manage because the country was angry. When a country is angry, it's very hard to show reasoning to them. This election is very different. Of course, Lula has an advantage. Of course, you know, I'm not saying Bolsonaro, he does have a very solid vote, which is about 30 to 35%. But people are looking at the Brazilian economy. You know, it didn't do very well. We had this experience and it was not entirely successful. And I think that's why Lula has the advantage. In 2018, people were angry. And I think perhaps that's what's happening in Italy. It is very difficult. Perhaps one lesson here. I think it's also interesting to look at the economy and other elements, because I remember in Brazil, we also have the culture wars. I think the culture wars, it kind of angers me in a way, because for some reason, the far right parties, they always manage to win the speech. You know, this expression, woke snowflake, we don't have that one in Brazil. We have one that is me, 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 which is the far right people. They're like, oh, you're full of me, 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 which means you're complaining about everything. For some reason, it sticks to people's mind. But I think this year, Lula's campaign has been very smart. Of course, there might be what they called me, me, me. But he focused a lot on economy. You know, food is expensive under Bolsonaro. He went really for things that really matter for average Brazilians who are living in poverty, because poverty increased in Brazil. So it was a little bit of an economic disaster as well. So perhaps that's the lesson I could give.
And just a final thought, Chiara, and expanding on that from Fernando, angry. Do you think that's an accurate characterization of Italy as it prepares to vote this weekend?
I don't know. I think that Italians are, I guess, weary in certain respects of a political class that feels very bureaucratic, that feels quite separate from the population. There is this sense that there is a system of power that is completely entrenched and impenetrable. And that's why all these populist parties have always made headways. And there is some truth to that, you know. This image of the kind of bureaucratic machine is very true in Italy. And Giorgia Meloni has on her side that her party was basically the only one that was in opposition in the mega massive kind of coalition that was behind Draghi. So, and that, you know, everywhere internationally viewed that government as fairly stable, and I'm sure that it was in international eyes, but it was a big pastiche of things. And Italians, seeing it from the inside, could see that there was a lot of, you know, compromising of ideologies, and that never looks good from the inside. And that's why an outsider like Giorgia Meloni at this point has the upper hand.
Chiara Romello and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24 and to Milan now, where the latest iteration of Milan Fashion Week is underway. And among those gathered there for it is Monocle's fashion editor, Natalie Theodosi. Natalie, first of all, we are now accustomed to talking about fashion weeks and trade fairs and festivals being back up to normal speed. Is there a general business as usual feeling about Milan this week?
Hi, Andrew. Yes, there is definitely a business as usual feeling. And I think there's even more of an influx of fashion industry professionals to Milan this season, just because everyone had the craving to return. Any taxi that I've been to has been complaining that the fashion people have quadrupled the traffic in Milan this week. So definitely a lot of buzz going on and a lot of people here for the fashion week.
So is there a general theme or mood discernible on the runways once you actually get into the shows?
There has been, yes. And this season, the mood is a little bit more somber and toned down. We've been sitting in a lot of dark rooms and all black runways, and the clothes as well have been toned down a lot. We're seeing a lot of blacks and grays and slightly safer, more familiar pieces like suits and trench coats and knitwear. You know, when the world was reopening, the narrative in fashion was let's celebrate with a lot of optimistic, colorful clothing. But I think the designers are very aware, either consciously or subconsciously, of everything that's going on in the world, politically, economically. So, you know, things have been toned down quite a lot, and we're returning to a quieter sort of luxury and timeless classic clothing that I guess will make smarter investments as well for people in the coming months.
Well, I know that we're seeing certainly new beginnings for two of Milan's great family houses, Missoni and Etro. What have you seen from them?
Yeah, Missoni and Etro made their debut today, this morning, and it's the first time that the families stepped back and gave the reins to new creative directors. I think Missoni got mixed reviews this morning. There was lacking that sort of warmth and familiarity that we were used to when Angela Missoni was designing the collections. But Etro, which has now been taken over by a young Italian designer called Marco De Vincenzo, was great and received a really positive response from the audience. I think he mixed Etro's history and signature of patterns and its bohemian spirit with a bit more of a youthful spirit. So I think Etro under this new creative director will keep growing and we'll keep hearing about it.
So those aside, is there any exhibition or any house whose new stuff is especially anticipated this week?
Yes, I think Gucci was the golden ticket today in Milan. I've actually just come out of the show. And it was really, really interesting. There was two shows happening at the same time, even though we weren't aware of it at first. We were sitting in a room separated by a partition with another part of the space. And towards the end, the partition was lifted and we realized that there was a whole part of the audience sitting in front of us. And the models walking on either side were twins. So quite theatrical, and once the partition was lifted, the twins got together and walked the finale. So that was really interesting, and it was a touching tribute to the creative director, Alessandro Michele's mother, and his twin sister.
And was the Gucci show, did it reflect that kind of somber retreat into classicism you were discussing?
In a way, yes, actually. Again, there was very ominous music, a dark room, like what has been happening in every other runway. And there was a lot of more classic tailoring and toned down colors. But Gucci being Gucci, there was also some louder evening wear. And that's what Alessandro Michele does, I think. He manages to mix it all together. But yes, it was a lot more classic than it usually is, reflecting what's going on the past week.
And what else are you most looking forward to while you're still there?
There's another full day of shows with a lot of the big names still to show, including Bottega Veneta tomorrow. Moncler is also going to be celebrating 70 years in business and hosting a really big show at the Piazza del Duomo and inviting the public to participate. So I think that will be quite interesting as well, because fashion shows are really becoming real spectacles, and the public can participate in them. So I'm looking forward to that tomorrow night.
Natalie Theodosi, thank you for joining us. And finally, on today's Daily, from the fall of the Taliban until their recapture of Afghanistan last summer, the lives of ordinary people in Afghanistan have had to respond and adapt to the political turmoil around them. A new film, My Childhood, My Country, 20 Years in Afghanistan, attempts to uncloak the experience of one individual during this time by following the story of Mir Hussein from boyhood to adult life. Monocle's Sophie Monaghan-Coombs tells us more.
The Taliban is now out of business.
We will honor those commitments of rebuilding Afghanistan.
Phil Grabsky is a British filmmaker. He believes he was the first foreign filmmaker to travel into Afghanistan after the fall of the Taliban in 2001. Once there, he headed to Bamiyan and met those who had been internally displaced to the city and were now living in its surrounding caves. In the harshness of the setting, he meets a particularly charismatic young boy, Mir Hussein, who stares down his camera lens.
Over the next 2, 3, 4 days, when I'm wandering around Bamiyan, getting to know people, he was always there with his 3 or 4 friends, always smiling, had a very cute little hat, very cute face. And the third night, I asked some of the men if they would take me into the caves, where there's this network of carved steps and kind of cubby holes, and it was, you know, it's an exciting place to go into. 1,000 years ago, it would have been full of Buddhist monks. And the men said, oh, we can't, we're too exhausted, the kids will take you. And in that moment, when Mir and his friends took me on a little tour, which again, some of this footage is in the film, I suddenly thought, and I'd say it's the best decision I've made in 250 films, I thought, he's the story. Because over the next year, I went 3 times over a period of a year, he is active, he is going to be going to school, he is going to get up to mischief, and he did and more. But also it will project an audience to think about the future of Afghanistan, not just about the past, but about what's going to happen. Is our intervention, how well are we handling it? How much is it actually helping Afghans? How much is his life being improved or not? And, you know, as I said, it was probably the best decision I've made as a filmmaker.
The film My Childhood, My Country, 20 Years in Afghanistan, follows Mir for 20 years. In doing so, it becomes an incredible document of his life and Afghanistan as the country changes around him. Phil didn't plan to film for so long, but as Mir grows up, getting a job, marrying, having children, as his story continues to be written, Phil, alongside his Afghan co-director Shoaib Sharifi, continue to film it.
We decided to follow his life for 10 years and couldn't have anticipated all the scrapes and all the things that happened to him. You know, we were there filming the one day that some foreign troops came through the village. You know, foreign troops visited that village once and they couldn't get out quick enough. The village has a mountain behind it. People used to graze their goats on the mountain, grow wheat. Then they discovered it was a mountain of coal and it became like the Wild West, a gold rush. Yeah, so lots of things I could not have predicted happened that changed Mir's life enormously.
The film combines huge changes to the Afghan way of life, such as the arrival of foreign troops, with the universal moments of teenage life. Mir's attempts to use a mobile phone to speak with girls in Kabul is one example. Eventually, he becomes a cameraman himself and films the joyful excitement of football matches alongside other events like the frequent suicide bombs taking place around him. He begins to shoot moments which become part of the film in which he's already playing the main character. For Phil, this film holds Mir's stories as well as lessons for all of us about filmmaking and journalism focused on Afghanistan.
There is really no such thing as the fly on the wall that has no impact. You have to be very responsible about how you behave with that, in this case, how you behave with that family, with that individual, both while you're filming and after you've finished. You know, before you even start, you have to think that your responsibility to those people will not end when you complete the film. So there's lots to be learned by watching this film. And the great thing about Mir is that he's such an extraordinarily entertaining, enthusiastic, optimistic kind of companion over these 20 years. He never once said, I don't want to be filmed anymore. And I gave him, you know, it's his, you hear his words throughout the film. And right at the end, I said, what's your conclusion? I didn't tell him what to say. I was rather surprised that he had such an optimistic view of things. Basically, he says, you know, there's no point being pessimistic. I can't go through life being pessimistic. I have to be optimistic. Then the Taliban returned. I'm still amazed by his resilience.
That was Phil Grabsky, co-producer and co-director of My Childhood, My Country, 20 Years in Afghanistan, in conversation with Monocle's Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. That's all for this edition of The Daily. Thanks to our guests today, Ty Genright, Chiara Ramella, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Natalie Theodosi. Today's show was produced by Lillian Fawcett and researched by Emily Sands. Our sound engineer was Callum McLean, with editing assistance from David Stevens. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time on Monday, the other side of tomorrow morning's grand final. Khan the Cats.